Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
If your appliances can't handle the holiday hosting heat, December deal drops at Lowe's makes upgrading easy. Get up to 35% off select major appliances, and rewards members save an additional $40 on the Whirlpool electric range and the over-the-range microwave. Plus, get up to 60% off select ladders so you can deck all the halls. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 12/10. While supplies last, selection varies by location. Loyalty programs subject to terms and conditions. See Lowe's.com/terms for details.
Let's talk.
John Brown.
Once upon a time in La Liga, Spanish football's forgotten tales, Brendan Madden delves into the archives and the secret files and speaks to those who were there to uncover Spanish football's most incredible hidden stories. I'm delighted to say that joining me live from the touchline, probably at some exotic footballing location, I don't know, Osasuna or something like that, is Brendan. Brendan, good morning to you, sir.
Morning, Giles. How are you doing?
I'm very well, so. So are you in Deportivo La Crawley or something? Whereabouts are you?
Deportivo Muswell Hill.
Ah, the ultras there are the most feared, of course, of all. Explain a little bit about your interest in La Liga then, and how somebody from Muswell Hill suddenly, you know, is it the Spanish sun? Is it the passion they bring? Is it just the completely bonkers tales that inspired you to write this book?
Yeah, definitely that. A bit of the bonkers aspect of Spanish football definitely attracted it to me. I've got a bit of a weird background in it, actually. I kind of came from numbers. I'd spent 20 years in the sort of analytics industry, like analysing Spanish football in like excruciating detail. And I kind of left that industry, but over that two decades, I kind of grew quite a strong attachment to Spanish football. And I didn't want to sort of leave that behind. So when I sort of left that analytics world, I kind of swapped numbers for words and started looking around. And Spanish football definitely, and I suppose you'll know, Giles, and your listeners will know, the transformation Spain's had in the last 50 years. Definitely Spanish football lends itself to some really, really interesting tales. Some that obviously delve into sort of the politics of the country, the culture of the country. It's just fascinating. Once you sort of start picking away at those sort of little seams, you find these little gems, and that's what the book's about, really. It's an attempt to try and find some of the stories away from sort of the usual sort of glitz and glamour of Barcelona, Real Madrid. And yeah. They are in there, but in ways you might not expect. So, yeah. Sorry, Josh.
Yeah, because I was just going to say, looking at the front, because, I mean, a lot of people just go, okay, Barcelona, Real Madrid, that's it. Those are the two sort of leviathans of La Liga. However, you're looking at the front cover of your excellent book. You know, not only is there, you know, are there, you know, people who are not Real Madrid players, but there's also a picture of Franco on the front, who was a massive Real Madrid football fan. He used Real Madrid as a political weapon, and so I'm glad that you've sort of like highlighted that one for a start, because that would be a bit like, I don't know, Maggie Thatcher going, right, everybody's got to support Arsenal or something like that, wouldn't it, or Norwich or something, or, you know.
Yeah, I guess the idea of putting him on the front was kind of like a lot of the stories, and not necessarily for the Real Madrid thing, which, I mean, people could debate that, but I'm sure there's PhDs written on all that sort of stuff, but more of the sort of, a lot of the stories, he does sort of hang over it. Do you know what I mean? Especially that the opening story does kick off at the start. We start in Santander, it's the first chapter, and it's two players who did a little humble protest against the Franco regime the last time they used the death penalty. So 1975, we're coming up to the 50th anniversary of Franco's death this month. Mm. And in that sort of dying embers of the Franco regime, they were quite repressive, even more repressive than usual, used the death penalty. And yeah, we start off with these two guys who just wore little bootlaces around their arms as a little gesture of protest. Played the first half of this game. They scored a goal between them. One of them crossed for the other. And they go into the dressing room at halftime and it's just full of armed police. They tell them to take their armbands off. Next day, they have to go to court. They're fined. The government want to send them to prison. They get sort of death threats from right-wing groups and the mail's confiscated, all this sort of stuff. And yeah, they're going around town and people are telling them how bad they are. So that's the sort of, yeah, that was the sort of opening one. Two amazing guys. And again, a thing about the book that's been a real nice experience is like tracking down these guys, people who are close to these stories, finding them, chatting to them and sort of telling their story to a new audience if I can.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things is, I mean, I was lucky enough to go to the El Clasico about 30 years ago in Barcelona. And it then became apparent because you couldn't sort of highlight your national identity if you were a Basque, for example. Athletic Bilbao is a story in itself with the way they select their players, you know, have to be Basque. But also, Barcelona was the only place that you could, if you like, you know, sing your national song, as it were, and have your cultural identity. So it became, you know, Barcelona, they always say they're more than a football club. And they, you know, and that's just a marketing saying. That's absolutely the truth.
No, it's true. And then if you see the front cover of the book, there's a little picture of two guys with the Basque flag. And that's actually a little vignette of a story. I think it was 18 months after Franco had died, but the Basque flag was still illegal.
Yeah.
So they stitched together, one of the players' sister stitched together a flag. They smuggled it into the stadium. And before this Basque derby between Athletic Club and Real Sociedad, the two captains come out with that flag. And it was... they were on tenterhooks. They thought, well, we could get arrested here, but the police did nothing. And then think about two or three months later, they actually legalized the flag. But even 2 years after Franco's death, that flag was illegal is sort of mind blowing, really.
And one of the things is because of the huge nature of Spain, it's a big country. You don't get an awful lot of away supporters. So what basically happens is then any football stadium you get becomes the focal point, doesn't it? So you get these folks, and that's why if you're a hero in Spanish football in your town, you really are, because there's no away supporters to sort of jeer you. You just get adulation from the crowd.
Yeah, and I think more so than football in England, and especially in the Premier League era, definitely is the regional thing stands out for me in Spain. It's really, really strong. Like you guys down in Andalusia, the Andalusian teams have got a real strong identity and a lot of local players.
Yep.
And then you go up to Galicia, Celta Vigo, Deportivo, got their identity, a lot of local players, a lot of local pride. To the Basque Country, to Catalonia, obviously, Madrid, Valencia. So That's another thing that sort of helps me write a book, certainly, when you've got those sort of strong cultural things. And even, yeah, we start off in Santander and the book ends in, not far from you guys, in Cadiz. And that's got its amazing culture as well with the carnival. And the book ends at the carnival in Cadiz with all those sort of characters from that amazing city.
If you're going to have somewhere to end, Cadiz during carnival is a pretty good place. And also, but it's really funny because, you know, I mean, Malaga is my team because where I am. And I find it really interesting because I used to live in a village about an hour and a half in the mountains behind Malaga, right? This place called Antequera, right? Which has got its own little football team. And this village literally had about 500 people, 600 people in it. So I remember they had a peña, you know, a local supporters club for Barcelona, yeah? And they had a local supporters club for Real Madrid. And these people, I was talking to them in the bar because I watched El Clasico there, which is another funniest thing ever, the most surreal experience. So you're sitting in the bar, and I brought an English mate with me, and we're sitting in the bar there, and we walk in, and it's a bit like the Westerns, you know, where the door opens and it all goes quiet, you know, and I'm chatting away to them because I speak a bit of the language. And we were looked as outsiders until Sergio Ramos, the fearsome Real Madrid defender, kicked his opposite number really hard in the plums, right? And everybody winced, and they looked around, and we were wincing too. So we were then, come and sit. But they were supporters of Real Madrid, even though they'd never been to the coast. And they celebrated Real Madrid won, and somebody had an actual fire alarm siren, one of those jobs, right? Air ride siren, right? And they were letting off fireworks, and you just thought, you wouldn't get this in if you were sitting in Leeds. You certainly wouldn't get, I don't know, a Tottenham supporters club like that. It just goes to show how pervasive they were. You either supported one or the other sort of back in the day.
Yeah, definitely that sort of, yeah, that big two sort of dominate Spanish football and Spanish society, really. And I guess that's probably one of the things that, probably one of the downsides of it, that the big two dominate so much. And I guess this book is a little bit of an attempt to sort of redress the balance a little bit, take the sort of eye off El Clasico. I mean, and the other thing is, there's so many good books and so much attention has been given to El Clasico now. So it's hard to add more, really. So this book trying to steer us away from it. I mean, yeah, there is still Barcelona, there's still Real Madrid, but in sort of quirky sort of ways. But yeah, trying to sort of redress that balance a little bit.
One of the things I really, as well, is how English players and English sort of football people have become integrated into Spain. So, you know, Toshak came over here, you know, that we had Laurie Cunningham, of course, the great Laurie Cunningham was playing in Spain when he was tragically, was he killed in a car crash, wasn't he?
Yeah, exactly that.
Yeah. And then, of course, we have, you know, and he unfortunately passed away not from far from where I am now, but of course, the Liverpool legend who became the voice, one of the voices of football in Spain. And he's originally from Blackpool. Explain.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, as you said, we've had the Brits and come over with it. And, yeah, you got this lad who grew up in a B&B in Blackpool, played for Liverpool, good number nine. He sort of came over at the end of his career, sort of 87, 88 sort of time. His knees were sort of struggling at that point. He signs for Osasuna, plays for Osasuna for a couple of seasons, and his knees give way. So he cancels his contract. He says he doesn't want to get paid for the football he can't play. But he's already become a little bit of a hero in Pamplona.
Yeah.
He's already fallen in love with the country. He's definitely getting used to his long Spanish lunches, and the chapter sort of revolves around his love of this long Spanish lunches. And obviously, we're talking about Michael Robinson here, who then goes on to work in the media in Spain and becomes this absolutely huge star.
Yeah.
I mean, hard to explain. He's like, he sort of transforms the media scape a little bit. He turns it from sort of tactics and sort of, you know, moaning about analysing referees' decisions. But he turns it more into a sort of human thing. You know, he'd rather like talk about a seven-year-old boy going to his first ever game than like analyse a penalty to death, you know.
Because that's the thing. If you listen to Spanish commentary, which I do because I drive around a lot and have it on the radio, it's commentary in Spain is at 1,000 miles an hour. It's like, and shout, go, no, and penalty, and it's mayhem, right? But Robinson had this sort of like almost sort of, it was like chatting with an old mate or an uncle. And it was that, and because he was a, you know, he was a giddy, he was a foreigner, but his Spanish was spot on, but with a slight accent as well, just enough. It really, he really became like one of the best loved figures. I mean, I don't think there is, it's kind of in a way that I'm trying to think of a UK equivalent to a foreign, you know, a foreign player. But he became, I mean, almost like a, I was going to say almost like a Satan Greaves, but you know what I'm saying? He was that much part of the fabric of not only Spanish football life, but sort of Spanish media life, football. Stop.
Exactly. I think the closest equivalent might be Lineker in the UK, but obviously Lineker's English. So, but for someone to come over and become so big, and I think it's always hard to get it across to people how big he was in Spain. I think I spoke to Sid Lowe, who knew a journalist, the Guardian football correspondent. He was very close to Michael. And I think he put it, the way he put it, most simply, is there was a version of Spitting Image in Spain. In the sort of 80s, I can't remember the name of it now.
Yeah,
but
I remember that. Yeah.
But not only was Michael Robinson's puppet in it, Michael Robinson's puppet presented it. So yeah, like, how big do you have to be for your puppet to be the presenter of Spitting Image? And I think he was the voice of like the one of the, there was, his voice was in Shrek, the Spanish version of Shrek. And I was really lucky for the book. I spoke to three people who were very, very close to him. And obviously his death was only 4 years ago, just at the start of COVID. So it's still sort of quite raw, and a lot of people really sort of miss him. So it's quite an emotional chapter to write. And I think another nice line from Sid was like, you know, when he died, he had this, he got cancer, and he sort of suffered for quite a while. But I mean, even when he announced that he had cancer, it was front page news in Spain.
Yeah.
And Sid sort of said, yeah, this is sort of sadness. He goes, it was like everyone's uncle was dying in Spain.
I think I saw Souness, and he was literally in tears on one of the Spanish TV programs.
Yeah, because it was, exactly. Yeah, 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 yeah. Souness was very close to him as well. So, but incredible character, and like sort of become a bit of a hero of mine.
Yeah, I mean, also that's because of the language. There's a natural sort of progression of South American talent. You've got, you know, Ronaldo, Ronaldinho. Is that Valderrama with the amazing hair? Is he on the front page as well?
There's a good chapter on Valderrama. So there was a period in Real Valladolid. So it's good to get another sort of. There was a period where they had a chairman who brought in sort of the cream of Colombian football. So he brought in Carlos Valderrama, Leonardo Alvarez, René Higuita was in goal.
No, the scorpion goalkeeper. For those of those who don't remember that famous save.
Yeah, yeah. If you don't know René Higuita, put it in YouTube and you'll have a good whole day.
So
we had this chairman who brought in them, coached by the most famous Colombian manager of all time. So this whole sort of new experiment, it didn't go very well at all. The Valladolid kind of got this reputation of being quite a sort of very serious, austere sort of city, conservative city. Yeah. Suddenly you got these three guys with like crazy corkscrew hair, moustaches. You got a goalkeeper who's like flicking the ball over a centre forward who's coming towards him. All this sort of stuff. He was getting barracked by the fans, and the results weren't good. Higuita left pretty quickly. Valderrama and Alvarez battled on, but it's left probably one of the weirdest images in Spanish football history was left by this spell. And there's a game at the Bernabeu between Real Madrid and Real Valladolid early in the season. And for some reason, there's an ongoing battle between Valderrama and Michel. Do you remember the midfielder for Real Madrid?
Course. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And gets to the point at a corner where Michel decides the best way he wants to provoke Valderrama, and does so by basically grabbing his meat and two veg.
Yes.
So you're left with this very strange image. There was like outrage for weeks. Michel got fined and sort of... I think he got fined. He got away without being suspended, but an image that went on for quite a while, and it's quite nice actually. They brought it back. A Spanish magazine, Libero, really good football magazine, touch of genius. About 3 or 4 years ago, they recruited Valderrama for a testicular cancer campaign.
Oh, genius! Absolute genius!
They played the footage of Michel touching Valderrama's testicles, and with Valderrama instructing men how to respect themselves.
let's move swiftly on in case somebody is enjoying their morning plums this morning as a breakfast. But Deportivo La Coruña. Now I always talk about Deportivo La Coruña because they were champions of Europe, and of an unlikely team that's going to be, because if you know your Spanish geography, La Coruña is up, you know, top left basically. You know, it's Galicia. It is a land of mists and horrible weather and etc. And there's a
rugged, mysterious
coastline. And they plummeted. I mean, they plummeted like a sinking ship that hit the coastline out from European champions. I think they're bouncing around second, maybe even third tier at the moment.
No, they're on their way back. Actually, they're doing quite well. They're sort of heading back through. So they're up there fighting in Segunda, and they got a wonder kid called Jeremy, a kid from the Canary Islands who everyone's been raving about. I haven't seen too much of him myself, but yeah, they're an amazing story.
So who's the handsome fellow on the front cover? Because he's opposite Ronaldinho, so he must be quite good.
So this is an Espanyol player, handsome as hell.
He's definitely wearing a Deportivo La Coruña t-shirt anyway, or a shirt.
Oh, that's Espanyol, the sort of the Barcelona team.
I'm reading the badge now anyway, but anyway, but moving swiftly.
Club Deportivo Espanyol. Yeah.
My mistake. Sorry. Oh, there you go.
Yeah. No, so a lot of these clubs all seem to be Club Deportivo.
My mistake, I just saw the blue and white and I immediately assumed it was Deportivo La Coruña, but it is Espanyol. You're right and I'm not. So who's he then?
He is a very handsome man who has a very, very sad story, actually.
I've got it bad on two counts there. Nice one. I'm doing well so far, Brendan. Come on, get me out of this hole.
if you looked at him and he's... it looks very much like John Travolta.
Yes, indeed.
And he was very much, his career did actually sort of follow that sort of 1970s glamorous sort of, he did sort of encapsulate that sort of Saturday Night Fever.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
He was not shy of the nightclubs in Barcelona. He was actually really, sad story with a few quirky twists. He was left at an orphanage at the age of five.
Oh, right, okay.
His dad died young. He's brought up in this orphanage and ends up sort of leaving there at the age of 14, knocking around Barcelona, trying to make a lot of life for himself. But he's a really good footballer. Gets signed by Espanyol, who are the second biggest club in. But he that's the first place he really feels like family. Espanyol, they love him. He loves everyone at the club. He loves the kit man, you know, the groundsman. He loves everyone there. But he's so good, such a good player, sort of a player in the mold of Beckenbauer. He ends up signing for Barcelona for big money.
Ooh, that's not a good move for your Espanyol player.
No, and he could have gone to Real Madrid. They were fighting out for his signature. That a lot of people say he would have been better off going to Madrid. But he's this sort of non-conformist character. He's fallen out with people.
What's his name, by the way? Sorry, just off.
Canito, sorry, yeah.
Right, yeah.
He's doing things like trying to bring his German Shepherd dog on the team bus on away trips.
Right.
So a very sort of erratic character. Falls out with everyone at Barcelona. Goes back to Espanyol. It's not a prodigal son story. He falls out with people there as well. Goes on from there. I'll leave it to people.
We want people to buy the book. Also, you've got, because the boardrooms, I've been to enough Spanish football press conferences and they drive you mad because it's men in suits talking about this, then the other. And, Barcelona and Real Madrid's press conferences with the people in the board make succession look like play school. But there's a story about a boardroom, one of the boardrooms standing up, is it against the ETA and drug cartels? What's that about?
So, yeah, two separate ones, actually. So let's go with so there's a Celta Vigo director. Her name's Carmen Avendaño. She was Celta Vigo director for a while.
Yeah.
And she was just basically a mother in sort of 1980s Galicia when the drug cartels were really strong and heroin sort of hit streets. In a big way. It was a bit of an epidemic in Spain in the 1980s.
Huge problem.
And two of her sons sort of got sort of hooked, and a lot of people in the neighbourhood were getting stuck. And obviously these mothers didn't know anything about it, and suddenly they got a sort of... She was like president of the classic residence association you have in Spain. You normally sorted out the rubbish or sorted out, people closing doors.
The annual meeting is like the trade union congress on steroids.
Make sure people close the doors, make sure people put the rubbish out. And suddenly you got this epidemic, and she sort of organized a group of mothers, and she sort of said, look, she flipped the whole argument. She said, why should the stigma be on us? The stigma should be on the people bringing this stuff in. So she basically led these mothers, basically were going to these bars and going to these meetings and denouncing these people, and eventually got enough traction from that they had to be taken seriously by the government. So there was a lot of people obviously didn't want to prosecute, couldn't prosecute, but eventually got taken very, very seriously by central government, Balthazar Garzon,
the superstar
judge you have in Spain. He led the fight against it, and there's some massive crackdowns which eventually dismantled these mysterious Galician drug clans.
Yeah, that's a brave move. Let's leave them on a high note, Brendan. Cadiz. A city like no other. I've been to matches at Betis, for example, which is my second team, because I just love the fact that they're not Sevilla. And if you live in a little village in Andalusia there, right, you will drive towards Seville, and every little roadside cafe has got Betis green and white, which is brilliant fun. But Cadiz is a very small city, but my goodness, when they were in La Liga, I mean, such fun. I mean, everyone would go to Cadiz to watch because it's just such a great party town.
Yeah, and the football club encapsulates that totally. I mean, they've got the fans have got this real wry sense of humour. Like, it's a place where, you go to a ground where a referee makes a bad decision and the crowd are on top of him booing him. There they call him Guapadon. Yeah. So, hey, referee, you're so good looking. Yeah. You know, they've got that amazing sense of humour. And obviously that just, that's distilled from the city, and they got this city of real sort of characters, quirky sort of people. And I was there in the summer, and you walk around and you see these characters, and it's just got that. I mean, it is basically essentially an island, isn't it? It's connected to Spain by this tiny strip of land.
It's an isthmus, or whatever they want to call it, isn't it?
Yeah, like 80 meters wide or something. I drove down it in the summer, and you're like, it's bonkers. And they're on this little island. They've had like nothing ever sort of works for them. You know, it hasn't quite modernized like the rest of Spain. You know, Everything they try and do, they're sort of restricted by space. But the people have got this real humor, and a carnival's this thing that only happens. Well, we think it's only 2 or 3 weeks every sort of February, March time. But it's a year-round thing, you know. You've got these people like who sing in the streets, who are thinking about little stories and little acts, and that all year round. And I was lucky to speak to two or three of the main sort of carnival sort of figures there. And the chapter sort of focuses on Manolo Santander, who was like really the main hero of carnival, and it was one of his songs as a tribute to Cádiz when they were really struggling. That sort of organically became the sort of anthem of Cádiz. But so it's a really brilliant song. And if anyone wants to Google Google it, they'll have it in their head all day. It's brilliant.
There you go. There's your homework.
But yeah, but also more than that, a real opportunity to look at those sort of characters. There was one guy, a sort of McCarty, his name was, a sort of middle-aged guy. He used to basically work in the markets, ferrying coffee around, but his whole life was dedicated to sort of Cádiz. And he was like the first person to wear the colours. He sort of, before kits were even sold, he made his own sort of kit put a little badge on it, and he used to go along, and people thought he was bonkers, but like a real beloved character. Like there's so many in Cádiz.
And the thing is, because of Spain, and I'm going to go down the cliche route, but there's such a love of life in Spain, isn't there, in a way that you're not going to get if you're Huddersfield away on a Wednesday. And so therefore, writing, and it sounds like, Brendan, researching this book was an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, real joy. Just to speak to people and then to share their stories. And I suppose the benefit actually of going after people that a bit unknown, you don't you might get hold of a footballer or a manager or whatever, but they might give you 10-15 minutes of time, you know, squeezed in between other things. But you're speaking to people for two, 3 hours. The chapter I wrote at the start, I flew over and met one guy, Sergio, in Valencia. I spent 2 or 3 hours with him.
Went for lunch.
Flew up to Bilbao and met Aitor on the balcony of his like an Asador that he has up in up in Getxo. And look, these people are just so generous with their time, and it sort of just makes it easy to write a book, to be honest, when people give you that much. Some real emotional stuff, and just so lucky to be able to speak to those guys, and a real life-affirming experience to do it and put it together.
The book is called Once Upon a Time in La Liga, Spanish Football's Forgotten Tales. It's by Brendan Madden, who is speaking to you today. Listeners, if you go onto the Talk Radio Europe website, go to the virtual bookstore, click on the front cover, and it will wing its way to you. Brendan, if people want to follow you and say nice things or have an argument about Spanish football, Deportivo La Coruña, on social media, if you've got a website, where can people find you?
Yeah, I've got a handle on X, which is Football S La Leche. I'll let you explain what La Leche is.
Indeed.
If you Google the book or Google my name, I'm sure it will come up.
Brendan, it's been great to speak to you, and even if I can't recognise my football teams, but I'm putting that into my age.
The book, get the old glasses.
Indeed. I should be a referee. I quite like the Guapatado. I'll referee, but only if it's in Cádiz. The book is called Once Upon a Time in La Liga, Spanish Football's Forgotten Tales. It's by Brendan Madden. Brendan, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Thanks very much, Charles.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.